Syria, and we have latest see, like when the ISIS came, they have, you know, they taken out the body, his body, out of the grave, and it was, you know, it was
perfectly preserved.
It was preserved perfectly. So how a person can be preserved for 1,400 years? So it means that this religion that we are following is the true, and those companions who were following the path of Ahlul Bayt, and they were narrating the hadith, they were the rightly ones.
Sayyid, is it true that the Khulafa also gathered these ahadith and burned them, or is that just a historical myth?
It's been narrated in the history. Obviously, we cannot say it's a historical myth. There are the many narrations, and the historian has said that they have collected what they could collect, and they have burned some of the scripts. It has been said in the history. Now we cannot say like this is the way it has happened or not, because the fact says that something which has been narrated in the history, it is in the history. Now, if someone believes or not believes, it's another matter. But the main point is, even if they have burned it, obviously the people, they knew it. And the main source of ahadith was Ahlul Bayt, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said in the Quran that ittaqullah wa kunu ma'as sadiqin. This is one of the verses, chapter 9, verse 119. On top of that, the Prophet also has said that inni tarikum fikum al-thaqalain kitabullah wa itrati ahl bayti. I'm leaving amongst you two things, the book of Allah and the household.
So some made sunnati.
Well, those who have...
Which sunnah are we having if you are burning the narrations?
The point is, if they have said sunnati, if they have sunnati, they need to bring a proof from the Quran for the sunnah. Kitab Allah wa sunnati, they need to bring a proof. Whereas when we say that Kitab Allah wa itrati, we have a proof in the Quran. Chapter 9, verse number 119 says, ittaqullah wa kunu ma'as sadiqin.
Right.
Be God-weary. You know, being God-weary is from the Quran. When you follow Quran, you become muttaqi.
Yes.
Ittaqullah comes from the obedience of the Quran, by reading the Quran. وَكُونُوا مَعَ الصَّادِقِينَ, and be with the truthful people. These truthful people are the infallible imams. These are the Ahlul Bayt. And Fakhr Razi has also said in his Tafsir al-Kabir that this كُونُوا مَعَ الصَّادِقِينَ must be infallibles. He has argued, he has proved that it should be infallible. Why? Because in the beginning of the verse, Allah says, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا, those who believe. It is only an infallible who is above the mu'mineen, over the believers. Allah cannot say, O believers, be with the believers.
Makes
this is
no
something
sense.
Wing. Right. So basically, there should be an infallible. And this is proved by Fakhr Razi as well in the book of, in his Tafsir, Al-Kabir. So basically, we have this proof from the Quran that Allah said, when the Prophet has said that Thaqalain is Quran, Kitab Allah, wa Ahlu Bayti, Itrati Ahlu Bayti, it is more acceptable that Prophet has said this thing. So inshallah, we believe that we can follow the footsteps of Ahlul Bayt, and in order to reach to the pure Muhammadan Islam, inshallah.
And may Allah aid us all in following this pure form of Islam. Sayyid, I thank you for your time and for participating. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. Until next time, fi amanillah.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Li Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
On behalf of the youth concerning justice for the world, a new paradigm response to the leaders' letters to the youth in Western countries. The title of a 90-page book authored by retired British binary economics professor Rodney Shakespeare.
The book addresses the main issues for the world today. For example, this massive inequality. There are preposterous accumulations of wealth. There's no justice. The exportation of justice is, in fact, in the example that Iran is capable of giving as Iran develops the resistance economy.
The book, to be translated into multiple languages, picks up on two open letters penned by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in the wake of a rise in terrorist attacks in 2015. Among them, the Charlie Hebdo attack in Paris, which fueled Islamophobia in the West.
Islamophobia started immediately after the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Although it surprised many in the world, they didn't have any strategy or plan, following which several false flag operations were created to damage the image of Islam. And it was necessary then to address the issue.
In those letters circulated widely online, Ayatollah Khamenei urged Western youth not to believe prejudiced portrayals of Islam by Western mainstream media or people in power, but to keep an open mind and judge the Muslim faith fairly.
The Muslim community are kind and peaceful people, and it's ridiculous to prejudice a whole in like huge community just because of the actions of one or two people that aren't following the faith that so many of them believe in, and that it's unfair.
More than anything, Professor Shakespeare's book is an economist's view on some of the biggest issues facing humanity, from the vices of capitalism to climate injustice, and whether Islam is the answer. The final chapter envisages the makeup of a true Islamic economy.
At the heart of an Islamic economy is the use of money, which is genuinely interest-free, not pretend. And when you understand that, when you understand that money is today created out of nothing, the way is open. A massive supply of interest-free money, as long as it goes out and is repaid and cancelled. And you can use it in countless ways.
In a world where Islamophobia, as well as economic and other injustices, are on the rise, Professor Shakespeare argues there is a need for a new reset, a paradigm shift. And it's exactly that paradigm shift, he proclaims, that terrifies the West. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The first shipment of U.S. military supplies has arrived in Ukraine. The military contingent is worth $200 million and includes ammunition. The delivery follows the conclusion of the latest round of talks between Washington and Moscow over Ukraine. Russian troops are massed on Ukraine's border, along with an arsenal of tanks, fighting vehicles, artillery, and missiles amid the U.S.-led NATO buildup near the border with Russia. Moscow has denied planning to invade Ukraine, but the White House believes an attack could come at any point. As the crisis escalates, EU leaders have become increasingly vocal in expressing their discontent at the exclusion from the diplomatic top table.
It's not just the US and Russia. If you want to talk about security in Europe, Europeans have to be at the table, and the agenda isn't just the issues Russia has put on the table.
Many believe that the EU is currently politically divided and lacks a unified approach on the Ukraine crisis. France's President Emmanuel Macron has said that the EU must open its own talks with Russia rather than rely on Washington. Macron hopes to revitalize four-way talks between Russia, Germany, France, and Ukraine, known as the Normandy format. However, the Baltic states bordering Russia seek a hawkish approach. On Friday, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania announced plans to send anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles to Ukraine after receiving authorization from Washington. But Germany disagrees with this approach, with its defense minister Christine Lambrecht ruling out arms deliveries.
We have to do everything to de-escalate. Currently, arms deliveries would not be helpful in this respect. There is agreement on this in the German government.
The German defense minister says Ukraine will receive a complete field hospital together with necessary training in February. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has stressed Berlin's policy of not supplying lethal weapons to conflict zones. Berlin is also under pressure from the US and other Western allies to stop the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which will carry Russian gas to Germany and the rest of Europe. EU and US leaders have time and again said the project should be halted if Russia attacks Ukraine. But Germany has warned against linking the natural gas pipeline and the row with Moscow over Ukraine. Meanwhile, the EU was sidelined from talks held last week between Russia and the US, NATO, and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. The EU has threatened Russia with severe economic sanctions if it attacks Ukraine, but the 27-member bloc is divided as to what should trigger sanctions. It seems that as the crisis over Ukraine keeps unraveling, the division among the EU states on one side and that between the EU and the US on the other side is becoming more evident and increasingly widespread.
As COVID-19 restrictions are eased, millions across the EU are returning to work. However, many businesses are struggling to stay afloat due to rising energy prices. The pandemic has resulted in more people working from home than ever before. Their bills are also out of control. EU energy ministers met on Saturday to discuss the crisis.
Être plus efficace.
We need to be more efficient, better interconnected. We need greater solidarity when it comes to security of supply. We need to stop wasting energy and protect citizens from more energy poverty.
Consumers are angry at the EU for not being better prepared to ensure sufficient supplies.
It's getting ridiculous when you're paying like 150 a month and you're used to this amount and then it gets raised to 300. It becomes a problem.
With the pandemic, like you said, it's really difficult because people are struggling economically. They're getting fired from their jobs. Some of them are struggling to find new jobs, and this is coming even more.
Governments in 22 of the 27 EU member states have taken temporary steps to try and support businesses and households. But so-called energy poverty continues to rise.
Many ministers mentioned how the situation beyond the EU eastern borders creates uncertainty on the markets and how the gas flows from Russia have dropped significantly in recent months.
But the European Commission acknowledges Russia has honoured all of its gas supply contracts. Moscow insists it's willing to supply more if new contracts are signed. This has already happened with Germany and Turkey, the Kremlin says. As was stated recently in the European Parliament, perhaps the best way to ensure energy security would be for the EU to stop using Ukraine to provoke Russia. This, as Ukraine is corrupt to the core and at the highest levels, according to the European Court of Auditors, which is the EU's financial watchdog. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
There's no end in sight for the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen. Riyadh and its allies commit yet another inhumane crime amid the deafening silence of the United Nations and other international bodies and so-called advocates of human rights. Saudi warplanes bombarded the western city of Hodeidah and a detention center in the northern city of Saada within hours. Dozens of people, including children, were reportedly killed in Saada alone. The overnight strike on Hodeidah also left several casualties, most of them children. The strikes triggered a nationwide internet blackout in the country. The Norwegian ambassador to the United Nations, whose country holds the presidency of the UN Security Council for January, has reacted to the strikes.
New attack or series of attacks is at least 60 dead, maybe as many as 100. I mean, that can't be acceptable, can it?
No, I mean, it's not acceptable, and we absolutely call for restraints on all sides.
On Friday, thousands of Yemenis staged a rally in Sana'a to denounce the latest deadly airstrikes. protesters condemned the United States for arming and backing Riyadh and its allies in the war in Yemen. The coalition has stepped up airstrikes against Yemen in recent weeks, killing dozens of civilians, including children.
Now we have become afraid day and night and in the morning. You don't know when the strikes will happen. The homes of citizens are now military targets, and this is what we fear. You fear that you will take children to school or to the hospitals or something like that, and you will get hit.
The spike in Saudi-led aggression follows Yemen's successful operation deep inside the UAE in retaliation for its role in the Saudi-led onslaught. During the operation, several sensitive locations in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, such as airports and oil refineries, were targeted with drones and ballistic missiles. Saudi Arabia and its allies, including the UAE, launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015 in an attempt to reinstate a friendly regime there. The kingdom has also maintained a blockade on Yemen ever since it began the war, while the impoverished country is in dire need of basic supplies such as food and medicine. Years of bombing and blockade have left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and displaced millions of them. The impoverished country is experiencing what the UN has described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Twice a week, help is sent out by the truckload. Donations made to this charity in West London on their way to families hit hard by the rising cost of living. For other charities, it's an everyday job. Nearly 2.5 million people used a food bank in the UK last year. With inflation now the highest in three decades, charities are warning it's only exacerbating an already dire situation.
The striking thing is how fast prices are rising. Bread up by more than 4%, margarine 27%, eggs more than 5%, and apples up by a fifth. The same with other staples. Put them all together, and you're talking about a sharp rise in the cost of living.
And that's just food. There have also been rises in the cost of transportation, clothing, and energy. Utility bills are expected to go up by 50% in spring, affecting some more than others.
You'll notice it, but it won't affect you too much. The poorest will have been most affected by this. Those with the narrowest shoulders are taking the worst of the burden, which we need to reverse to try and make sure it's those with the broadest shoulders to take most of the weight.
Economists say the UK is facing a perfect storm of COVID, Brexit, and global supply shortages. The question now is whether the government's proposed ways of mitigating the pressure on the people are enough.
The good news is, so far, the capitalism has started to grow again. It's actually building back up. But they haven't addressed the issue of fairness, and over the next few months, this is going to be particularly painful in Britain. The cost of power, potentially doubling in the next few months, will mean that some people will go into fuel poverty, almost certainly.
These are just snapshots from across the country of a resurgence of poverty. And it looks like for many in the UK, things are going to get worse before they might get better. Saeed Puriza, London.
Protesters outside the Israeli embassy have called for a boycott of Israel and those who support it, the delegitimization of the Zionist regime by Britain, which gave birth to it, and an end to apartheid.
We see you! We know your complicity! And we won't let you enable the ruthless and barbaric actions of the Israeli state in our name.
Israel is finding it more and more difficult to prevent the global community from knowing what's going on in the occupied territories. No amount of algorithms can stifle the cry for justice, and more people are standing in solidarity with the Palestinians. For decades, Israel has been chipping away at Palestinian neighborhoods in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Now it set its sights on Sheikh Jarrah. In May 2021, this neighborhood became an international focal point, with residents resisting expulsion using digital activism. The diaspora was galvanized, 180,000 people took to London's streets, and the land grab was postponed as a result. Londoners say the videoing of atrocities is working, but the Israeli lobby is strong.
Mona Al-Kurd, who is from Sheikh Jarrah, as she was transmitting the demolition of the garden center of the Salha family, her Instagram was blocked. So as far as we can, Palestinians and supporters try and portray to the world what is happening there. What we need to do is to find ways of turning that into a change in government policy.
The message is getting out. I'm of an age where I went first to Israel in the 60s, shortly after the Seven-Day War. People in this country did not know about Palestine. There was no understanding of the Nakba. There was no understanding of the expulsion of Palestinians. And for years and years, the Israeli government was allowed to continue, and this ignorance was perpetuated by the media.
Racism is a hot topic in the Western world, with people rising up against all forms of discrimination and inequality. And for many, Israel is synonymous with racism.
I think there are still organizations like the BBC which do not report what is going on in the ground. Therefore, tools like social media are really, really important.
They're not going to get away with it. And as Martin Luther King said, the arc of history may be long, but it bends towards justice. We will win this fight because justice will win.
Demolitions have begun, some in the dead of night. Stun grenades were used, the power cut, and dozens arrested. The ethnic cleansing continues, as does the fight to end the last apartheid on Earth. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Russia's guided missile cruiser Varyag and its anti-submarine destroyer, the Admiral Tributes, paraded along Iranian and Chinese warships in Iran's southern territorial waters as the last phase of a joint naval maneuver, codenamed Maritime Security Belt, conducted over 17,000 square kilometer area in north of the Indian Ocean. The one-day drill engaged some of the latest naval equipment of the three participating countries.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy, together with the navies of the Russian Federation and the People's Republic of China, staged a joint drill with the motto of Together for Peace and Security. The ultimate goal of the exercises is to enhance the readiness of the three countries in confronting marine threats that are posed to civilian seafaring.
China's Urumqi destroyer and Iran's domestically built Dena and Jamaran destroyers were among the vessels that were deployed to the drills. The trilateral maneuvers saw the three navies practicing anti-piracy operations, where they freed two commercial ships from pirates. Iran's Navy says the drill will significantly boost the three countries' coordination and synergy in combating piracy and ensuring the safety of international shipping in the strategic Indo-Pacific region.
North of the Indian Ocean is of a special significance in terms of global trade. That's why it is associated with constant threats such as terrorism and piracy. Therefore, closer cooperation between the actors in this region promises safer maritime trade for all countries.
North of the Indian Ocean hosts more than half of the world's maritime oil trade, which passed through three strategic straits of Hormuz, Bab el-Mandeb, and Malacca, together forming what's known as the Golden Triangle of international trade. It's the third time Iran, China, and Russia are holding a joint drill in this body of water, with the aim to turn the thruway into a safe transit route for all passing ships. Iran, Russia, and China wrapped up their joint military exercises with strong messages. On top of them is their growing naval cooperation to ensure a collective security in the Persian Gulf, the Sea of Oman, and north of the Indian Ocean. This as they advised Western actors in the region to avoid destabilizing activities. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
Iran warns that Israel is exploiting the United Nations mechanisms and other international bodies to cover up its daily crimes against Palestinians. In a statement, Iran's foreign ministry stressed regime has always tried to use the victims of crimes in the Second World War to justify atrocities against Palestinians. Ministry said the regime has subjected Palestinians to all sorts of violations, especially crimes against humanity. It said that genocide, terror, and ethnic cleansing are just some of the crimes the regime is committing against Palestinians. Ministry further stressed Israel maintains the same racist and expansionist ideology that triggered crimes committed during the Second World War.
Is the British Home Office abusing its powers by denying a former Guantanamo Bay detainee his citizenship rights? That is the accusation being made by Cage's outreach director Moazzam Beg, who announced he's taking legal action in the hope of winning back his passport.
I've been arrested under terrorism laws three times, and I've had my passport taken away three times, all without any due process, all without any access to legal recourse, and all by governments of Britain, both Labour and Conservative, and yet I have not been convicted of any crime. I've never had my day in court, and I have actually been declared innocent by the very police that arrested me in the first place.
Moazzam is a British human rights defender who was made famous when he was detained and tortured by the US in Afghanistan's notorious Bagram prison and Guantanamo Bay between 2002 to 2005. Ever since his return to the UK, Mr. Beg's passport has been seized three times in just 8 years, the latest being in September 2021.
I gave evidence at war crimes tribunals. I have given evidence to the International Criminal Court for Britain and America's role in torture and abuse there. And I've looked at Britain and America's role in the rendition program with countries they claim not to have good relations with. And that, I believe, has been one of the key reasons why I have been targeted.
Beg has been accused of support for extremist groups in the past over his aid and investigative work in war zones such as Syria and Afghanistan, but was always found to be innocent. The Home Office has yet to publicly comment on this latest passport matter. This battle will be very significant, especially given the fact that Number 10 is currently trying to gift itself new powers to essentially remove people's citizenship at will with the controversial Nationality and Borders Bill. Many critics fear that the government just simply can't be trusted to wield powers like this fairly. Robert Carter, London.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In Britain, Labour and Liberal Democrats have called for full transparency now that it has emerged Sue Gray's report may just summarize findings. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's deputy political editor, Rowena Mason. The piece is titled PM Facing Calls to Ensure All Evidence is Published in Number 10 Party's Inquiry. Britain Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing calls to ensure all evidence on the Downing Street parties is published with the Sue Gray inquiry. As it emerged, the pivotal report is likely to amount to a concise summary of findings. Labour and the Liberal Democrats called on Friday for the report to be published along with its accompanying evidence, including emails and witness accounts, to give full transparency around more than 15 alleged parties under investigation by Sue Gray, a senior civil servant. The publication is expected to have huge political ramifications, as many Conservative MPs have said they will await its findings before deciding whether to back Boris Johnson to stay on as Prime Minister. If they are unsatisfied, he could face a no-confidence ballot. Government sources said the report was likely to be ready at some point in the middle or end of next week, and Sue Gray could hand it to Number 10 Downing Street. It is understood Boris Johnson will get advance sight of the report, but then he's expected to make it available to the public and Parliament within hours. The terms of reference of the investigation make it clear that findings will be made public. However, The Guardian understands that that does not include accompanying evidence, such as emails, text messages, or transcripts of interviews, or precise details about what happened at any of the alleged gatherings. Government sources pointed to the outcomes of the investigations into Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, and Damien Green, the former Deputy Prime Minister, as examples of how such findings tend to be set out. Both ran to less than 2 pages. The investigation file, including the evidence on which the findings rely, is unlikely ever to be published, the sources said. This may mean an email allegedly sent by a senior official warning Boris Johnson's principal private secretary, Martin Reynolds, not to have drinks in the Number 10 garden on 20th of May 2020 may never be made public. The email is crucial, as Boris Johnson insists he was not warned that bring your own bottle event might be against the rules, and that he was unaware it was a party when he spent about 25 minutes there speaking to staff, believed to number about 30 to 40. The findings will instead be statements of fact about what happened, while leaving the matter of any disciplinary action to the civil service and the Prime Minister. Boris Johnson could decide to refer himself and any other ministers to the Independent Advisor on Ministerial Interests, Lord Gate. Redactions from the findings of the names of junior staff and the potential for any disciplinary action against them are also possible. Andrew Rayner, the Deputy Leader of the Labour Party, called for a greater degree of transparency around the parties, which have provoked outrage across the country, from members of the public to Tory MPs. Boris Johnson cannot be allowed to cover up or obscure any of the truth when he has insisted on a hugely protracted internal probe to tell him which parties he attended and what happened in his own home. The Sue Gray report must be published in its entirety with all accompanying evidence, Andrew Rayner said. Rayner said transparency in government has been eroded under Prime Minister. The Conservatives have shown us how little respect they have for the rules. We've seen private WhatsApp, missing phones, a Freedom of Information clearinghouse, lost minutes of lobbying meetings. Their cover-up culture has lost the trust of the British public. Ed Davey, the Liberal Democrat leader, also joined calls for more transparency around the report. Ed Davey said, "Trust is an all-time low, So this report must be open to scrutiny from all those who've lost loved ones and all those who stuck to the rules. Aside from personnel and employment issues, Boris Johnson owes it to the Parliament and above all to the British people to publish this report and the transcripts in full. Anything else will be seen as the usual lies and bending of the rules. Despite the decision not to publish accompanying evidence, several current and former civil servants who know Sue Gray said they believed the report would still be an accurate and potentially damning account of the parties that would not shy away from difficult conclusions. They pointed to the Green investigation, which she led as head of the propriety and ethics team, and resulted in his resignation in 2017. However, other former civil servants highlighted her ability to navigate her way through tricky political problems, which has led to the nickname Sue Gray Area. Gray's investigation has consistently been described as independent, despite her being a senior civil servant reporting to the Prime Minister. Asked whether the probe was independent, Johnson's deputy official spokesman said on Friday, "Yes, it is. It is. For that inquiry, that team, to establish the facts, we've said this before. It's an independent investigation team. I think we've set that out from the start." The spokesman was asked what about the inquiry made it independent, and he said, "Well, and we've set out it's being run independently by a civil servant who's been asked to establish the facts." On Friday night, new details emerged about two parties allegedly held at No. 10 Downing Street on 16th of April last year for the departure of James Slack, then Boris Johnson's Director of Communications, and a Downing Street photographer. James Slack has since apologized unreservedly. About 30 people attended both gatherings, with the photographers taking place in the basement of No. 10, while James Slack's colleagues met in the press area. Both groups later met up in the garden, the Daily Telegraph reported. The newspaper was also shown a photograph of revelers in the basement of No. 10 Downing Street, although it is unknown if this or any related text had been seen by Sue Gray. The basement party reportedly went on for at least 7 hours, until 1 a.m., according to the text messages seen by the Telegraph. Wine was spilt on a government printer as music bellowed from a laptop. A takeaway pizza was ordered into No. 10, it is alleged, with slices handed around the garden, while other partygoers took turn on a slide bought for Boris Johnson's infant son, Wilfred.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamadi.
Islamadi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the merciful. This is Youth Station, and I'm glad to be here. Well, we have my friend.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wassalamu alaikum.
I'm Zainab, Sister Asma's co-host, and I'm totally happy to be with you guys today.
Well, today we're going to discuss the very interesting topic of parenting and the things that we as children have to do to them. We respect them, we love them, and we honor them, we obey them. How do we have to treat our parents, the people who gave us the chance to live the existence? They gave you the pleasure of being a human being. as the people who gave us our existence and as those who treated us very much kindly, though I know their parents were not kind and there are some bad parents as well.
Yes, I feel like we so need to talk about that.
Yes. That is very important because it changes the life of people for the rest of their life.
Exactly.
That would be the end of them. Yes. Having good parents is a great chance in life.
Such a blessing.
Yes, it's a blessing, of course. So after all, we have to respect them, whatever they are. Mm. We have been advised on that issue.
You know, sometimes respecting your parents, your abusive parents, exactly. I worked with children for a few years of my life.
Such an interesting way.
And I saw a lot of awful parents. And I think that has led me to constantly point out abusive parents whenever we're talking about the topic of parents on our shows. My parents were awesome. God bless them, their souls. Shout out to mom and dad, wherever you are. I love you. But it's important to talk about abusive parents because it's important to talk about the other side of the story.
Yes, exactly.
And sometimes respecting parents looks like staying away from them.
Yes.
I'm not saying entirely cut ties with your parents.
I know what you mean.
But just creating that distance between you and parents. So, because if you're around them, you're going to disrespect them. You're going to talk back. You're going to give them that death glare. You're going to give them
And maybe
attitude.
They'd be heartbroken.
Just stay away.
Yes.
They've already done their damage.
Keep the distance.
Yes. They've already done the damage. Best you can do is not increase it, not make things worse.
Yes, that's true.
Right?
Do you think it has always been like this, or nowadays we see more of bad parenting?
I think nowadays we see better parents. People are becoming more aware, more informed.
Is it?
I mean, in a lot of countries, spanking your child is now illegal.
But they do other things. I mean,
like
there
what?
Is...
Like what?
I know that sometimes at some point of life, divorce is the best thing you do.
Mm.
But the children did not really understand that. They are the victims, and they would suffer. They're going to be the ones who are going to suffer.
Are you implying that they won't suffer growing up in a loveless household and a...
No, I don't
marriage.
Mean that, but I have seen that in some families, if they reduce the amount of selfishness, there'd be a happier life for the children, and they do not have to live without their parents, either mom or dad.
Mm.
So I just feel that nowadays, as a whole in modern world, people thinking more about their benefits. Now, if they're parents, they do not, or maybe they think about the future of their children, because that's very illogical not to think about the creature that you have brought into this
world.
But maybe they did not give it such a, they do not feel the burden of parenting. I would rather call it this way.
Mm.
I mean, if they try to change the situation for the good of their children, that would be plenty much better.
But why does parenting even have to be a burden?
Because it is a burden. When you have a responsibility, there is a burden. Okay, everyone who's been listening to us, stay tuned. We're going to have a break and then we'll catch up together. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Listeners of Youth Station, we're back and we're going to follow the discussion.
In the Quran, Allah constantly talks about ihsan toward our parents.
Yes.
And I feel like that's the word we need to dissect and digest. That's what we need to understand. What does Allah mean by doing ihsan toward our parents?
Yes, that's true.
Right?
Yes.
And what
even
did it
if
look
they are
like?
Bad?
Yes,
because
exactly.
If they're good and you're doing good to them, you're doing actually nothing. Mm. Not a very difficult job you're doing.
Yeah, it's actually innate even.
Yes.
It's natural for kids to love their parents.
Yes, of course.
And want to show affection to them.
The only people they are clenching in.
Mm.
The only people they rely on. So it kind of comes naturally, as just you said.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So when Allah says, do ihsan to your parents, be kind to them, be considerate toward them, even if they are mushrikeen, even if they're non-believers. Yes. And I have a lot of that among my friends and family members, that they were converts. My friends reverted to Islam, and their parents are still Christian, still Buddhist, still whatever. And they go back home, and obviously there's this huge gap now.
Such a difficult situation.
It's a very difficult situation, but oftentimes, my reverted friends' obedience of Islamic teachings and how it has displayed itself in their actions has created a stronger bond between them and their non-Muslim parents.
Yes.
Because they, through obeying these commands and instructions of the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, these individuals have become more compassionate, considerate, kind, respectful toward their
They've
parents.
They've been asked to be kind and to share passion.
Certain gestures of respect that otherwise did not exist in their culture nor interaction.
Yes.
They'd get up in front of their parents, they'd help their parents out, this and that made their parents feel like, oh, look, I like my child now more.
He's better now.
Yeah. And the thing about ihsan is it does not mean obedience. It means ihsan. You know what I mean? Sometimes we really need to define that line.
Yes, exactly.
Till what point am I supposed to obey my parents?
Yes.
Now that I am almost 30 and I live on my own and I have a career and this and that, is it still logical for me to obey my parents regarding my life decisions, regarding where I want to live, what work I want to do? Sure, for some cultures where children still live with their parents until they get married.
Yes.
Well, if you're not going to obey the person whose house you're living in, what are you going to do?
Yes, of course.
But in some other cultures, it doesn't even... What?
Yes.
You know what I mean?
The children get independent very quickly. At a certain age, I don't know, 18, 17, they leave the house and they have an independent life. So in that situation, it's a little bit of tricky to obey your parents. But still, God has asked us to always obey our parents, except from the time they're asking you to be a mushrik.
So go against the rule of God.
Yes, exactly. So see to what level God wants us to be kind with our parents. And still, we owe them a lot. Those people have done so much good to us, so we have to respect them. Of course, we love them, but some people do not define it this way, that if you love someone, you have to respect them. But as God has told us, we have to respect them as well and obey them in the things they tell us.
I also think that this sort of respect, this connection between parent and child is only possible if the child received it during the initial years of their life.
Exactly.
If the child saw respect, if the child saw
They should
affection.
Learn it.
Exactly.
You have to give it to get it.
Exactly. If the child saw kindness during those first years, then when they grow up, they automatically will give it back to
their
parents.
They understand the value.
And they will be naturally inclined or naturally capable of expressing those sentiments and gestures toward their parents. But if the child wasn't necessarily abused, I mean, abuse comes in a lot of forms, right?
Yes,
there's
exactly.
physical abuse, there's spiritual abuse, there's mental abuse, emotional abuse, and wonderfully enough, all of those things are possible to apply to a child. You can commit all of those
yes,
to
as
a
parents,
child.
You can
do. Yeah, yeah, you have that much power.
Learn those things from their parents, it becomes a part of them, and intuitively they would love to share that much of kindness or respect with others, especially their parents, the ones who had taught them those issues and facts.
Yeah, absolutely. But if a child grows up in a household where they're not necessarily addressed by favorable nicknames, it's these little things.
Exactly, little things do
These
count.
These little things.
Yes.
If the child was given a not very pleasant nickname as when they were young.
Yes.
If a child was treated harshly and roughly during a certain milestone, transitioning to school, transitioning from breastfeeding to bottle feeding.
Yes, exactly.
During their potty training, during the time where they transition from parents' bedroom to their own bedroom.
Exactly.
During these little times.
Yes.
Which is a huge deal in a child's life.
It has a great impact on them.
I mean, they're changing the course of their life.
Yes.
And we don't get that.
Even in psychology, we have that until the age of 7, the kids would learn everything. Actually, that's the first square is the most important part of their life.
Exactly. And the child was treated harshly or roughly with a lower than standard degree of respect because that's still a human being.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
It still has that part of Allah's soul and essence that you do.
Yeah.
I often think to myself, if you're not going to talk to an adult like that, you don't have a right to talk to a child like that.
Exactly.
You go
and
to
even
your
a child is more sensitive, so
than
you should care more.
Exactly, because their soul is so pristine and their heart is so soft.
Yes.
Then asking that child to display unconditional obedience, respect, and love toward that parent gets hard.
Very.
But nonetheless, the child's supposed to do it anyway. Their parents are not necessarily abusive, but they slip. They're only human.
Yes.
Yeah, you
course.
Don't necessarily have to, like, disown your parents or anything.
Yes.
But it's going to be hard, and my thoughts and prayers are with you.
Yeah, because you are doing a great job if you're doing it.
Exactly.
Well, what about those who do not have really good parents? I mean, the parents are not responsible to their child. It's not easy to leave your parents.
Don't
you know,
stay in
I
toxic
know some parents who do not even fund their children. I mean, they do not pay money for their education, for their clothing, or for anything.
So why did they bring that life into this world?
I'm telling you, there is a lot of these kind of people.
Yeah.
So we see a lot, we hear a lot. So
walk away, fam.
What do
walk
we do
away.
With these kind of parents?
You don't deserve that sort of toxic
Some
relationship.
Some people are
in
very distressful. They're very helpless. I mean, it's very
difficult. Yeah, your parents are already old. Just stay and take care of them until they die. What other choice do you have?
Yes, and that's very sad.
It is very sad, but that's just another test in life that we are going to have to power through, and then Allah's going to compensate. Allah's always going to compensate.
This was Asma and Zainab. This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you for listening to us.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because of you. I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker, abiding in silence with patience and guidance.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.